Buenos dias and bienvenidos. Welcome to this sacred time, made so by your setting aside this hour each week to come here and be in community, to share our love and to feel the spirit that moves among us, to hear the message of this faith and to be challenged by it. Today our service is going to take a south of the border feel. We'll even incorporate a little Spanish, and in spite of my poor Spanish pronunciation, my Spanish teacher says I speak Spanish with a French accent. So, Katie, you may have made it even worse this morning. When we do the covenant a little later in the service, we'll do it line by line, the English and then the Spanish. So I'll just give you a heads up on that. And we're also going to sing our first hymn, which is printed in the white section of your order of service, is going to be first sung in English, then in Spanish. But we begin with our chalice lighting. And Mike, would you light the chalice? Listen, did we have some? Great. The words are from an Aztec prayer. I invite you to join in. Grant me, God, a little light to guide me through this life, this dream which lasts but a day, wherein there are many things on which to stumble and many things at which to laugh, and others like a stormy path along which one goes leaping. And line by line, love is the spirit of this church. El amor es el espíritu de esta iglesia, and service its law, y el servicio es su ley. This is our great covenant, esto es a lo que nos comprometemos, to dwell together in peace, convivir en paz, to seek the truth in love, hablar la verdad con amor, and to help one another. Y ayudanos los unos a los. This morning at our 9 o'clock service, we had a wonderful ceremony. Was it a dozen? Ten. Ten of our second and third graders received their first chalice. It's sort of our version of a first communion or rite of passage when a child comes into the age of reason, as it said. And it was a wonderful event. And we talked a little bit about it, and we talked about the fact that they received this because it is the symbol of our faith tradition. So this morning, in this message for all ages, I just want to share with you where that all comes from. And by the way, there are these blue flyers that if you would like to know more information about it, they're at both doors on the way out of the church that explain it. Well, we call it the flaming chalice, so I need some help, maybe from the youth in the gallery. Easy question. Hint in the title, the flaming chalice. There are two parts to this. Someone want to tell me what the two parts are? Flaming chalice. Any ideas? Yes. There's a flame and there's a chalice, a cup, a goblet, a bowl, whatever. You know, each of those symbols have very ancient religious meaning. And let's start with the chalice. Many of you who come from other traditions or know other traditions that there's the Passover cup or the Seder cup in the Jewish tradition. There's the communion chalice in the Catholic tradition. There's the story of the Holy Grail, which is a cup. There's the Greek chalice that we see of an ancient Greek religion. What do you think that this chalice means? What does it mean to us? Just that part of the symbol. Anyone? And big kids can participate too. Anyone want to say what they think the chalice part means? Well, this could be a hint too. Diane? All-encompassing. It's a container. It holds something, right? It holds sustenance. You drink from a cup, right? It's a symbol of sharing. You share a cup. It's the open hands. It's the inclusive. It's the container that holds us all. It's love. It's sustenance. It's generosity. all of those things are part of it. Now, what about the other part of the symbol, the flame? That, by the way, is considered the oldest religious symbol in the world. If you go back way back to the Vedic hymns of ancient India, you will see the fire is operating as a symbol of the presence of the sacred. And we see candles in churches and temples, and we see bonfires on the solstice, and candles in the windows at Christmas time or Hanukkah time, eternal flames at monuments. So what are your thoughts? What do you think the flame means? Or does it mean to you? Spirit, okay. Enlightenment. Everlasting. Yeah, all those things. Illumination. It can also mean courage and sacrifice and witness to, you know, an idea or a principle. So all of that. And it comes together. Now, some people wonder, well, how did this get to be our symbol? And it actually hasn't been our symbol that long. It's only been our symbol since World War II, since the 1940s, or just before that even, when the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee was helping Jews and others who were being persecuted by the Nazis to escape. And they needed a code symbol, a special symbol that could help assure safe passage and help people identify who was friend and who was foe. And the symbol that they created was, in fact, the flaming chalice. They wanted it to have a religious significance and be easily identifiable. And that's where it comes from. And it was after that that our churches started adopting actual flaming chalices as part of their symbol. The whole story's in here if you'd like to pick one up and read it. And now it's our custom each week to, for those who are going to religious education, youth, children, mentors, teachers, to go led by a lantern. And the lantern is lit from a flame that we have kindled together in our common chalice. The idea is that we have all brought together the spark that we bring to create a common light. And from that common light, we send it forth with our children and youth. So, Michelle, do we have someone to carry the chalice? I couldn't hear you. Dervla? There you are. Dervla, it's an honor to carry the lantern. If you would light the lantern, go around this way. And everyone who's going to Ari, remember you call, follow Dervla and Michelle out. To lead into our time of silence today, I have a prayer that was written by one of the former ministers of this church, Edward T. Atkinson, who was minister here between 1964 and 1969. And I know there are maybe just a couple of you who were in the congregation at that time and remember him, right? His words. At this quiet time, in this place of worship, we would seek to know more deeply what it means to love one another. We know so well our own needs. We know that we ourselves need understanding, affection, and recognition. Why is it then that so often we hesitate to extend these precious gifts to others? The cost of a kind word is small. The moment that it takes to listen could hardly be better used. A gesture of forgiveness can mark a new beginning. An embrace or a note of appreciation can convey crucial encouragement and comfort. And yet so often we fail, even within our own families, to live by the sacred command that we should love one another. O Spirit of life and of love, strengthen our faith, increase our resolve to give more generously of ourselves. We pray for the courage to take the risks of love. We pray for the insight to see ourselves and others in perspective. We pray for humility and understanding, that we may always stand ready to forgive and begin anew. Amen. As most of you know, we're in the midst of our stewardship campaign here at the church, our pledge drive. It's so important that we all contribute, that we give of our time and our talents and, yes, our treasure generously. The support of this church depends totally on the members of this congregation. And indeed, you are a generous people. And during the stewardship drive, it's customary for us to reflect on what it is that all the programs that all this church has to offer means to us, and what is it that we are able to make available to other people by supporting this great institution. And everyone sees that in their own way. And several people have been asked to share, and this morning we have the privilege of hearing Kevin O'Brien.
Good morning. I am Kevin O'Brien. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees here, and I've been asked to say something about my experience at First Parish. As you know, these testimonies you've been hearing over the last few weeks are sponsored by the Stewardship Committee and are intended to remind you why you should make a pledge and support the congregation. As many of you also know, I serve as pledge secretary for the church, but I speak to you today not as a church official, but as a member of the congregation. Some years ago, we had a UUA consultant look at our congregation. This was before we began the capital campaign, and he was to evaluate the commitment of church members. I asked him what generally made people feel like they belonged to a church. He said, and I think this is good information, that in his experience, a person who had one or two friends in church who might do things with three or four people, who would talk with half a dozen people and who knew the names of 10 or 12 people, they felt at home in a church. Now, this seems like a pretty low standard. And I know for our part, Susie and I didn't come to First Parish to make friends or to learn people's names. We originally came about 28 years ago to expose our two children to some kind of church experience. I'm not really sure what I expected. Both Susie and I had been to churches as kids, not UU churches. I even graduated from Holy Cross College in Worcester, but had fallen away from that for a number of years. When we came here, something kept us interested, and the kids did stay in RE, and I'm reminded of that every time I look over at the quilt. Both my kids have made one of those squares. And we did begin to make friends. And I now count some of the congregations as my closest friends. And I have far exceeded the numbers our UUA consultant suggested. I'm really honored to count you people among my friends, familiar faces, really good people. But you know, you didn't become our friends just because you're good people. We came to know you by working side by side on efforts that meant something to us. It might be social justice, or we worked together to develop our own spirituality, or we worked together to put on the services auction, or any other number of things that we do here at church. And it wasn't just that the efforts were meaningful. Sometimes they were difficult. Difficult issues in running the church, or in our own spiritual growth, or in times of personal loss. But people here at First Parish have always been here for me, and it provided a safe atmosphere where no matter how difficult, I feel I can risk, where I can explore ideas, and where I can always try to do the right thing as I see it. I feel confident that other members of the congregation will listen and consider what I say and help me explore and decide the right course of action. This is a thing I consider extremely important in my participation in First Parish life. The confidence that I can always say what I think is correct, even in the face of more expedient or more political choices. If First Parish ever loses this quality, I walk away. But I am confident that will not happen. because this is a bedrock of the church. It's the reason that we're here and not at a country club. In these efforts over the years, I have not only felt that I have become a better person, I have experienced others becoming people whom I want to know. And this rarely happened in school, it rarely happened at work, but it happens at First Parish, and it is a large part of the reason that I want to support us here and as we grow and try and do. I'd like to mention something I've only really recently realized about First Parish. We have a nice building, great staff, terrific choirs and other music, wonderful social activities, and I tend to think that this is the way UU churches are. But I've been exposed to other congregations recently. As you did, I experienced several guest ministers recently. I had the chance to visit another UU church for a memorial service. And recently I attended a workshop held by the UU and attended by 25 other UU congregations, many of whom had the chance to describe their churches and the issues they faced. First Parish of Stowe and Acton is not the norm. We are among the best. There are many really good UU churches, especially here in New England, and several quite nearby. But there are many more who are struggling, many who do not have the inspired leadership that we have, many who have nearly fallen apart by the undertaking of a building program like we just finished with the connector, and many who have serious financial problems or have too few parishioners to be viable. We have a wonderful church. And I am very proud to be part of it, and I'm really, really grateful to receive the benefits of this rich and productive atmosphere where love is the spirit and service is law. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. All that is made possible by your generosity. And each week we give you an opportunity during the service for making a generous gift. And here, that gift not only goes to support all that this church has to offer, but it also goes beyond the walls to a specifically designated nonprofit, local, national, or international organization selected for each month. One half of the non-pledge offering is given away to them. And this month is especially important because, in a way, we are giving it to our own program. We're giving it to our urban ministry. We are one of 50 churches who participate in bringing all sorts of ministry to inner city Boston, from youth programs to domestic violence shelters to work programs to a variety of other events. So we particularly ask you to be generous, not just to this church, but to our urban ministry. The morning offering will be gratefully accepted. like to share a reading with you from the Mexican poet Octavio Paz. What sets worlds in motion is the interplay of differences, their attractions and repulsions. Life is plurality. Death is uniformity. By suppressing differences and particularities, by eliminating different civilizations and culture, progress weakens life and favors death. The idea of a single civilization for everyone, implicit in the cult of progress and technology, impoverishes and mutilates us. Every view of the world that becomes extinct, every culture that disappears, diminishes a possibility of life. Now, as most of you know, I just returned from 6 weeks in San Miguel de Allende in Mexico. It's a place where my partner Malcolm and I have been going for more than 10 years, and it's become our second home. From the first time we visited, we felt a profound connection to the place and the people. As the hymn we just sang reminds us, indeed, Mexico is a colorful place. Colorful buildings, colorful clothes, lots of fiestas, good times, happy and polite people. In a place like San Miguel, you combine this with beautiful architecture, great music, unbeatable weather, and fabulous food. It's hard not to be drawn to Mexico. But there's much more to Mexican life than just these colorful, showy things that we first encounter. The way Mexicans live their lives, who they really are, what matters to them, their values and priorities are as interesting to explore as the shops and historic sites. And I think there is much for us to learn from that exploration. You know, it's easy to think that Mexicans are just like their neighbors to the north, except they speak Spanish. But they are not. Mexicans have a very different history, different hierarchy of values, and different ways of interacting. Their society is structured differently. How one's time is spent, how we treat each other and interact with each other, how one expresses themselves, what's considered appropriate conversation, all are different. As Octavio Paz suggested in that reading, those differences are beautiful. Although some Americans living or working in Mexico act otherwise, hopefully we don't want to eliminate them by trying to make them just like us. Now, of course, we do have a great deal in common. But as I am learning, understanding the differences and conforming my behavior to the ways of my guest culture is more than just necessary. Doing so blesses me with an entirely different relationship with those Mexican folks with whom I interact. And it causes me to reevaluate the way I act and live right here in the U.S. as well. Lots of Americans don't get it when they're in Mexico. And I have to admit, I've made many mistakes acting out of ignorance or frustration. And even when I thought I was doing the right thing, sometimes I missed the mark. In Mexico, one of the not so nice things that they can say about you, call you, is mal educado. I hope that's the worst way that they refer to me. I hope that my behavior has never been so far off the mark as to be called a pinche propotentes, a term that is reserved for some Americans who live and visit there. It means arrogant jerk. But mal educado is bad enough. First, know that even if you meet the criteria for one of those insults, no Mexican would ever say that to your face. Even to have such a confrontation would be contrary to their values. Mexicans are not going to be confrontational, especially with Americans. They're not going to contradict or correct you unless you really know them well. It's more important to have an appropriate, polite social encounter than it is for the encounter to be truthful in expressing their feelings. They will often say yes, even if that's not what they really mean, because they don't want to make for an unpleasant social encounter, or they don't want to disappoint you. I've heard this particular scenario many times over from well-intended Americans. They get all excited. They're in Mexico. They meet some Mexican at a shop or in an event, and they say, "Will you come to my house for dinner or for a party?" That puts the Mexican in a tough position, because an invitation to someone's home is not a casual thing, but they have to give you an answer because you've asked. So they will probably politely say yes, but quite often they will not show up and probably will not call. Now to us, that seems rude. But to a Mexican, it would have been more rude to say no to you in the conversation. Malcolm and I have just started building a house in Mexico, and I'm thrilled to be working with a wonderful, young, talented Mexican architect. It's very hard for him to tell me anything he thinks I might not want to hear. I don't want to conform him to my ways, so I'm aware of this, and I try and figure that into the equation. And in truth, we sat down over a couple of cervezas recently and talked about how it would never upset me for him to tell me anything, like the delays, the problems, all of it. I explained to him, the only thing that would bother me is not to know. I'm not sure he's convinced, but we're working. We're working well together. But I know it's hard for him. When I first started working with him, I made demands. You know, I want these plans by this date, you know, etc. He would always say, "Of course." But things would never happen in accordance with my demands. We've had to interact with a variety of government agencies for permits and the like. To me, each interaction took at least 3 times as long as it should. My approach would be to apply pressure, and that would have no effect. The techniques we would use here in the States to get something done don't work very well in Mexico. Frustrated, I spoke with a friend who's lived in San Miguel for 25 years about this, and he told me about a Mexican saying. It goes, "In Mexico, to get things done, you push with a feather." It made sense. I've changed my style to a more gentle approach, and things are moving along, though slowly. But more than that, I've just learned to be more patient about everything. I've learned that if there is a death or a birth or a wedding in the family, everything stops for days, maybe weeks. Mexicans take time to celebrate life, and I mean all of life, the joys and the sorrows. Weddings last for days. When a girl turns 15, the celebration is bigger than a wedding. Everything stops for the Day of the Dead, when the life of the deceased is celebrated. My architect's mother died this past year. And even though she was gone, the whole family came together for a mass and a party to celebrate her birthday. And then, 3 days later, they came together again with another mass and a big feast because it was the anniversary of her death. They would never think of combining them. I've learned that if there's a family matter that conflicts with a work matter, the family matter always takes precedence. I've learned that if it's a day off or it's the weekend, nobody is going to answer your business email. Setting deadlines for the sake of setting deadlines is not helpful. And gentleness in business dealings will get you much further than demands. Gentleness and politeness. These days, I'm pushing with a feather. And amazingly, at least to me, for the most part, it's working, and I sort of let go of my concept of time and schedules, at least a bit. I've learned that for Mexican trade and business people, mañana does not mean tomorrow. It means sometime in the future. I have learned that if you are invited to a Mexican home for dinner and arrive at the time they invited you for, you will likely be at least an hour before any other of the Mexican guests arrive. Living your life by the clock is something we're so used to doing, it's really hard to depart from it. We love to have schedules and spend our days trying to stick to them. You know, we even would cut off conversations to leave for an appointment so we would get there on time, and we don't want to waste time. Well, in Mexico, it would be rude to cut off a conversation abruptly just so you can get somewhere else at a particular hour. And the very concept of wasting time does not really exist. Time is time. It's not something you waste or spend. It's time. It's not just the concept of time, though, that's different. Mexicans have a very different hierarchy of values. As I've reflected upon these differences, I've been guided by a wonderful Spanish teacher I work with, and a real expert in Mexican culture by the name of Warren Hardy, whose lecture really helped me to articulate what it was that I was seeing and experiencing. Now, I don't want to speak for all Americans, and I certainly have no right to speak for Mexicans, but I think it's fair to say that Norteamericanos value individual achievement, often measured in financial success, very highly. In fact, Mr. Hardy says that he places financial opportunity as what he sees as the American number one core value. Because we live that Puritan ethic still. It's work that gives us dignity, and our success at work is usually measured in the dollars we earn or the material things we accumulate. And we are so often judged through that lens. We too greatly value individualism, being the self-made woman or man, doing it on your own is the goal. And we move out of our family houses as soon as we can to establish ourselves on our own. Not in Mexico. Mexico is a much more collective place. Family is of utmost importance. Most Mexicans live in three or even four generation households, and they love doing it. The elderly who gain the title of Don or Dona are revered, as are the children. And from that family extends the community. And coming together with extended multi-generational family members, neighbors, and friends, just to sit and talk and sing for hours is time well spent. Of course, they wouldn't even say that, but it's good. Maintaining this family unit is more important than individual success or making money. You know, here in the U.S., we rely on laws and standard procedures, policies to resolve conflicts or to negotiate problems. Not so in Mexico. In Mexico, it is personal trust. It is the personal relationship of trusting an individual, not a system, that is valued. It's the way things happen. Now, as a lawyer, this has been a hard lesson for me to learn, but thankfully, with the guidance from some good Mexican friends, I'm getting there. But, you know, I think the biggest difference, the one I think that contains the greatest lessons for us, is understanding that number one core value is not a person's success measured in financial terms like the U.S., but is personal dignity and respect. Mexico is a culture based on respect. No matter your social standing, education, wealth, or lack thereof, everyone in Mexico is deemed worthy of being treated with respect. And it's not just words in theory, but it is in fact translated into daily actions. As Unitarian Universalists, you'll remember that our first principle is one where we affirm the equal worth and dignity of every individual. And I have to say, I think The Mexicans' understanding of that idea can teach us a great deal about what we, in fact, claim to uphold. The importance of personal dignity and respect, as well as the differences in other core values when compared to the U.S., has a great deal to do with the differences in our history. You know, the U.S. has its roots in those, you know, pilgrim adventurous people seeking a new world of freedom and unlimited opportunity, people who came seeking a new life, always looking to the future, always moving on, moving west, expanding, growing. Mexicans, for the most part, have their roots in being a conquered people. For 300 years, most Mexicans lived as slaves to their European conquerors. Although the Mexican Revolution of 1810 gained independence from Spain, it really didn't change the lives of most Mexicans, who remained, instead of slaves, serfs to the aristocracy for the next 100 years. Unlike in the U.S., they had really no opportunity to move, no real freedom. Their horizons were very limited. They stayed with the land. They had little control over their destiny. Economic success or power of position were simply not available to the vast, vast majority of people. Now, you should know that during those same 100 years, that period, Mexico also experienced 6 foreign invasions, including 3 from us. Mexican history books do not present the U.S. in a very favorable light. Mexican children learn of greedy Americans who took more than half of their land. You might be surprised to know that the general view Mexicans have of Americans is that they, the Americans, are morally and spiritually inferior to them. But this can be overcome when they engage with individual Americans. And here's how it happens. It's got some history. In the mid-19th century, there was a social movement in Mexico, the purpose of which was to give all Mexicans a way of maintaining and expressing personal dignity and respect, no matter how lowly their position. It reached across from the richest to the poorest. It's called the Cortesía, and it's still very, very much in effect today. Every Mexican mother has a duty to teach her child the Cortesía, and if anyone does not learn it and use it, they are called mal educado. There's the word. Okay. And it works like this. To every person that you encounter, that you walk into a room or a shop and see, or that you pass in close proximity to on the street, you are to give a formal greeting. It's either buenos dias, buenas tardes, buenas noches. It is how every conversation starts. And often then a title of respect, and if you know it, the person's name is added. So it might be señor or don or whatever. Next, whenever you wish to enter a person's space, and by the way, spaces are much closer. We have arm length comfort. They have elbow length comfort. So whenever you wish to enter another person's space, like if you want to pass them walking on the sidewalk, or even when you want to leave their space, if you're talking with them and you go on, you don't do it without permission. So it is always con permiso or con su permiso. And there's more than one response, but generally they respond proprio, so that, you know, that it indicates you ask for permission to enter their space. And there's always a response. They might say pase or whatever if you're walking on the street, but always a response. And finally, not only when you begin a meal with friends, but also whenever you enter a space where people are eating, such as like walking close to a table in a restaurant, if you're walking through the room, you are to give a blessing on their meal. It's buen provecho, but it's expected. Now, these things can seem very silly to Americans, but Mexicans do this all the time. And I have learned, for an American to be well received in Mexico, you must also practice la cortesía all the time. It says something much deeper than just what the words mean. It says that you acknowledge their history and struggles. It says you truly respect them and are not considering them beneath you. It conveys a respect for their culture. It is a great equalizer. It overcomes the negative stereotypes. It distinguishes you from the Norte Americanos of their history books. It demonstrates something very important, that you are a respectful person. If you practice La Cortesia, you will be amazed at the effects that it has and how people respond to you. So why preach this sermon? Well, it might be useful to you if you're going to visit Mexico, but my purpose is not to give tourist advice. What I've learned and am learning in Mexico has called me to take a real look at my core values and at how I'm leading my life, and perhaps sharing my experiences with you will raise some similar questions for you as well. I don't expect us to turn into Mexicans any more than we should expect Mexicans to change their ways to ours. But I do think some of the things I've encountered can help us temper our ways a bit and maybe live our lives a little bit better right here. Perhaps the Mexican experience can help us to see more clearly that there are many other measures of success than money and power. Maybe we can come to understand that gentleness and kindness in our personal and business dealings might work as well or better than demands and pressure. Perhaps we can learn from the ways Mexicans interact that the tone and the way we express ourselves, the respect we show or do not show by our words, is in fact very powerful. Mexico is a great reminder for us of what our first principle, the equal worth and dignity of every person, really means. And maybe really taking the time to acknowledge people's dignity with respect might help us to do what we say we do, affirm the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Look, we all know Mexico is no nirvana. There are lots of serious problems. But I think you hear enough of that on the news. So perhaps next time you see that negative news about Mexico, maybe you'll recall this sermon. And maybe if you ever go to Mexico or engage with someone from that culture, rather than impose American standards and values and ways of looking in the world, you'll at least consider that they also have worthy values and beliefs and customs, and that they can enrich our lives. And maybe you'll go further and apply some of those values and ways of living to your own life. It might just surprise you what a blessing that can be.